Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Louisa Wilcox, working for Natural Resources Defense Council, Sierra Club, Center for Biological Diversity, and Greater Yellowstone Coalition. Louisa has advocated for grizzly bear preservation for over 30 years. She specializes in developing comprehensive strategies that succeed because they work on multiple scales using various approaches, including grassroots organizing and outreach, education, media and communication, policy analysis, lobbying, coalition development, and public protest. She and a handful of others have prevented Yellowstone grizzly bear delisting for over two decades. Louisa has a BA from Williams College and a Master's of Forest Policy from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. In 2014, she was given a Lifetime Achievement Award from Yale. So first, thank you for being on the program, and second, thank you for your work.
Well, thank you. Thanks for being here. This is a great opportunity.
Oh, thanks. So basically, can you tell people about grizzly bears? Who are they? What was their former range? What was their former population prior to conquest by Europeans?
Well, grizzly bears, our grizzly bear Ursus arctos horribilis is its Latin name. It's not the black bear that people are familiar with. It is a very threatened bear, reduced in range now to places like Yellowstone and Glacier. Its habits are much more ferocious. It's also very secretive and very shy most of the time. It's at the top of the food chain, a large predator. And we humans have had a very interesting relationship with bears in North America, in Europe, Russia, around the world, wherever we've overlapped. And we and grizzly bears have seen in each other a lot. We see ourselves in bears. We see our emotions in bears, anger, love, humor, curiosity, and sadness. And grizzly bears have provided a window onto the health of the ecosystem for a long time. And so as goes grizzly bears, so go the health of the ecosystem. And they've been threatened for a long time, too, and never more than now, with human pressures in its last refuges as well as hostility. We continue to kill them at very high rates. There will be more killing of grizzly bears if the federal government has anything to do with it, with proposed removal of endangered species protections, maybe this year, and a trophy hunt for the first time in 40 years. If that happens, bears will be pushed right back to the brink of extinction. And that will be a very, very tragic thing and a statement about our ability to preserve animals and ecosystems.
So you talked about bears and human relationships, and you mentioned Europe as well. So are grizzlies only native to the U.S., I mean to North America, or were you talking about other species of bears for those?
No, the grizzly bear, they call them the brown bear in Europe and Alaska, but we still have grizzly bears in Romania. There's a few in Greece, even in Spain and the border of Spain and France still today. But there are brown bears in Europe and throughout Russia, some a very small population in India, for example. But same, it's Ursus arctos, same species.
So when they talk about Kamchatka bears, are those also grizzlies then?
Yes. They're very, very large grizzly bears, but same species.
Great. So what is their preferred habitat? Because we hear about, like Lewis and Clark writing about them on the plains. Are they basically plains creatures, forest creatures, both?
Grizzly bears are very, very adaptable, and they can live in the plains, they can live in the mountains. The one place they can't live is really hot desert, because they just don't sort of regulate very well. I mean, they've got really sick hide. They were on the plains. Lewis and Clark saw them there. They were primarily reliant on bison along the major river corridors there. Three major food systems that grizzly bears in North America relied on: the bison ecosystem of the plains, the oak ecosystem of California, Oregon, and the salmon ecosystem of the Pacific Northwest into Idaho. And of course, they eat a lot of different things. Like in Greater Yellowstone, they've got like 250 food species, but bears are big animals, and they need really big calorie foods to make it. So those oak you know, bison, salmon. They need, you know, big ticket items to survive. The federal government would have you believe, in the wake of losing some key foods like whitebark pine seeds in Yellowstone, that they can survive just fine on dandelions, but that actually is not really true.
So I remember reading, and in fact I put this in a book I've got coming out in the spring, but I don't remember the numbers right now, that grizzly bears in the fall, when they're really putting on the weight before they hibernate, don't they eat, okay, I'm going to make up a number, and I could be way off, but don't they eat like 50,000 calories a day or some crazy
even,
number?
Even more. I mean, they you know, yeah, 70,000 calories possibly. Yeah, they are just, they're in the fall, late summer, fall. What grizzly bears are doing is they are just packing on the calories, because what they're facing in the winter is 4 months of famine. I mean, they go into the den and they don't eat, drink, defecate, you know, for several months. And interestingly, they give birth in the dead and dark of winter, too. So they're the females are not only giving birth, but they're nursing for a month or two, you know, 2 months before they come out in the spring. So they've got to really be in good shape to pull all that off. So in the fall, they're just, you know, eating like crazy to do that. And they're interesting. So they basically, bears get obese, but they don't get type 2 diabetes. They, you know, that's why the medical community is so really fascinating with bears, because they don't get all these, you know, physical disabilities that you or I would if we, you know, ballooned to that kind of weight.
I live in what used to be grizzly bear territory. I live on the coast of California, just south of the border of Oregon, right next to the Smith River near it. And so I see black bears every day. And the point is that even though it's not particularly cold here, so they don't actually, capital H, hibernate, every spring the bears are fairly thin. And then all fall and into early winter, I mean, there's no word to use except fat. They're really, really heavy. And so I can imagine for the grizzly bears, once again, since they have to actually sleep for all that time with no food, that they just get really chubby.
Yeah, they have to. I mean, and, you know, it's interesting. Grizzly bears, too, and black bears, too, the one common story that Native peoples around the world had about bears was the story of transformation. You know, you watch bears, they seem to disappear. They seem to die in the winter. And then in spring, they come out with new life. You know, what is happening? You know, that's a real trick. And no matter how much research is done, and there is a ton of research done on hibernating bears, how come they don't get osteoporosis? How come their muscles, how come, you know, they still have muscles and they can walk in the spring after being essentially immobile for so many months? How come their kidneys don't fail? You know, how come all of these things? We still, science still doesn't have answers to all those questions. You know, it's sort of a jaw-dropping phenomenon. It's incredibly mysterious and miraculous. And yet here we are, we humans, you know, saying, oh, well, that bear's a problem. You know, let's just kill it. So anyway, it's really amazing the ability of these bears to adapt to winter conditions.
So before we talk about current populations in the lower 48, I want to bring up one more thing, which is that you were talking about, you know, all cultures around the world, or all cultures who encounter bears, have talked about perceiving these characteristics, you know, humor, whatever, in them. And once again, I see bears literally every single day here.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom has quite good relationships with them. And, you know, we can tell, you know, this bear is actually really kind of crabby. And this bear, they very much have, they are as unique in their personalities as you or I. Do you have any stories you want to tell about that?
Oh, absolutely. They're as much individuals like you and I. It's so funny just hanging around scientists, my husband included, and hearing them swap bear stories, you know, in Yellowstone or anywhere else, and hearing sort of stories about mother bears And, you know, well, she's a real floozy. You know, it's like the analogous, you know, mom who sort of hangs around in the bars, you know, constantly losing her cubs, you know, sort of, you know, distracted, chaotic, frantic. And then the mom who's like, you know, the analogous, you know, mom with muffins in the oven constantly, you know, with the apron and stuff. I mean, it's just a totally solid mom who's just knows, you know, where everything is and where her cubs are at all times. And, you know, yes, of course they are individuals and they have, you know, different personalities and different tolerances. There's a very famous bear in Jackson Hole right now. Her number is 399, but and she has figured out how to survive next to the rose near a lot of people. And she is constantly monitoring the safety of her cubs relative to people, and she hasn't had a problem yet. She's in the national park. And she's making, you can sort of watch her, you know, make decisions. Is it time to cross the road? Is it not time to cross the road? You know, getting the kids across, you know, taking advantage of an opportunity in the traffic. I mean, and just watching these bears make decisions about people and each other all of the time. And watching bears get freaked out by the presence of a big male bear amongst them. And some are more comfortable, some are less comfortable. Yeah, they really are. They're just like us. I mean, and that's why another one of the really old stories, and it's not just old, I mean, Indian people still tell these stories, bears are considered to be kin, guides, mentors. I mean, they really are like us. I mean, they're our relatives. And anyway, so, yeah, they have personalities. Some are grumpy, and some are happy, and some are joyful, and some are sort of, you know, reclusive. And, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I just underscore what you said.
Oh, I guess one more story about that just cracks me up is when we see sometimes males will come around and they will, especially in the spring, a lot of times they will like stand up and grab a tree and break it. Mm-hmm. And it always cracks me up because it reminds me of like teenager guys on a beach, you know, and they see a teenage girl and they all of a sudden start strutting and pushing each other around. It's otherwise, yeah. I can't figure out why the bear is suddenly, I mean, he was being quite normal. He sees the female and like, oh, time to break a tree.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Mating sort of, you know, acting out mating behavior. Yeah. It's very funny.
So,
and the bear marking on the trees, I don't know if you've seen that, where bears will rub up against these trees and you can see these bear trails up to the tree and where they're actually smooshing their foot and kind of rubbing it into the ground to sort of tell other bears, like, I've been here, yeah, stay out of here.
Yeah, I've seen that too. That's, yeah. So how many grizzly bear populations are currently in the United States, distinct and or indistinct, and what is the general population, and what is the trend of this population?
Okay, so we had grizzly bears before the European conquest. We had grizzly bears west of the Mississippi to the California coast and from Canada down to Mexico. And within relatively short amount of time, actually less than about 100 years, we reduced them about 99%. And where we have them now, the two largest sort of strongholds for grizzly bears are centered around Yellowstone and Glacier National Parks, Glacier National Park in northern Montana. There are three other tiny populations, one in northern Idaho in the Selkirks and a little bit of eastern Washington, one in the North Cascades, maybe a handful of individuals, and one in northwest Montana, the Cabinet Yak, which is sort of two sort of really tiny populations sort of together. So there's five populations left. The three really tiny populations border Canada and are contiguous with Canadian populations, but they're in no way stable. They're all threatened. They've been listed under the Endangered Species Act since 1975, all of them. And they're all threatened. They were listed because of excessive human killing and uncertainty about their population status and because of habitat loss. This is an animal that depends on large tracts of wild country. much more than many other species. And so, as goes wilderness, so goes the grizzly bear. And so these are some of the largest tracts of wild country that we have left.
And approximately what would be the total U.S. population?
We have maybe 1,600, 1,700 bears total, total among all of them. In Yellowstone, there's always a battle over numbers, but, you know, there's 720 or so individuals today. And probably a declining trend for the last 10 years. And probably a declining trend, this is according to federal agency data, and the trend is declining for reasons that are somewhat surprising to a lot of people, and I was among the people shocked at what's been going on myself. We have had a climate-driven phenomenon. Indigenous mountain pine beetle has been able to flourish at higher elevations and invade, essentially, white bark pine, our highest elevation pine stands in the Great Yellowstone ecosystem, that provides a really fat, high-calorie food for the grizzly bears, conveniently cached thanks to the red squirrel for the grizzly bear. I mean, not for the grizzly bear, but that's the outcome, is the red squirrel caches these pine cones in these middens, and the grizzly bears sort of figured out how to capitalize on that. And since about 2003, warming trends have allowed the mountain pine beetle to flourish at higher elevations and essentially clobbered the white bark pine forest. And what that's done is driven grizzly bears to lower elevations where they've encountered humans, and particularly hunters in the fall, hunting big game hunting season, at higher frequency. So grizzly bears are dying from encounters with hunters and encounters with ranchers, as they're seeking more meat in the form of, unfortunately, cows. And so we're having higher death rates and a declining trend for the last 10 years. But the government is moving forward willy-nilly to remove protections and start a sport hunt.
Okay. Did you say that there were, 1,200, 1,600? How many did you say?
I said 1,600 roughly total in the lower 48 states and 720 or so in the Yellowstone, the Great Yellowstone ecosystem.
Okay, so this really pisses me off that there's when I lived in Spokane, Washington, I had chickens, and I lived near coyotes, so of course coyotes would take some of the chickens, and
right.
You know, I just came to agreements with them. I didn't freak out. I just, you know, figured out you deal with it. And
mm-hmm.
I have read about and written about grizzly bears who have been killed for killing people's chickens in Montana.
Oh,
and
yeah. Uh-huh.
If there were 700 million grizzly bears, then we could talk about killing a grizzly bear because it kills your chickens. But when there's 1,200 of them left in the United States, that seems completely ridiculous to me when they eat some of your corn. Or I mean, my attitude on this is like, wow, how exciting is this that I actually got to see a grizzly bear eating some corn? I mean, that would be exciting as opposed to pissing me off because I just lost $30 worth of corn.
Yeah. I mean, it's outrageous, actually, especially because there are many opportunities to coexist with bears, and there are many techniques. There are techniques including guard dogs, you know, for livestock, you know, bear pepper spray, electric fence to secure chickens, for example. You know, many preventative techniques and new technologies that didn't exist even a couple decades ago, and people are refusing to use them. And instead, it's easier to call the state and say, oops, you know, time to get rid of this bear, he's pissing me off. Or, you know, and just off a threatened animal. Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's outrageous. I mean, there is a choice to coexist with large carnivores that have no place to go or not. And people are choosing not to. And not only that, there is a movement afoot. It's a state-led movement, you know, which I think is institutionalized hostility to large carnivores because they compete with big game, you know, the cash cows for these state agencies, you know, elk and deer and such. The states want to reduce large carnivores, including grizzly bears, because it means more big game to them. So it's not just that ranchers want to kill them. It's the states want to reduce their numbers, too. That's what this hunt's about.
I want to personalize this one more time. That is my, you know, I live with, I've mentioned several times, I see bears every day, brown or black bears. And, you know, my mom's doors, she will at some point have to replace her doors because the bears have chewed on them. And there are strips of wood that they've torn off, like right next to the garage door. But that's, oh, and there's the back bumper. I parked my mom's car outside one day instead of in the garage, and the bears chewed on the back bumper. And there's some chew. It's like, this is what happens when you live in bear territory. It's not, we haven't. If they make her too mad, she walks out and sprays them with pepper spray, and then they go away. I mean, this is just pissing me off that especially because black bears are not particularly rare. But if you have only 1,200, this is just dreadful. So let's go back a second, and you talked about hostility to predators, and I just a few days ago interviewed Michael Robinson about the war against wolves, and.
Yeah.
You talked about a reduction of 99% for the grizzly bears. Would you also say that there has been, this may be a stupid question, would you also say there has been a war against grizzly bears the same way there's been a war against wolves?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the westward European conquest was a war against the wilds, and that was the war against wolves and grizzly bears and bison and native peoples. I mean, it was a war against anything that threatened, you know, the so-called civilized way of life. And it was fairly organized, you know, equipped with the Bible. So that's, yes, absolutely.
And is there the same sort of visceral hatred of grizzly bears among many of the, say, ranchers or the population in general in the region as there often is? Oh, back up again. Also, I interviewed somebody about jaguar reintroduction to a section of South America, and they said they're actually the locals. He says it's an entirely different ranching community where they actually don't hate jaguars there. They can perceive it economically that if their jaguar eats one of their cattle, they are annoyed because they lost a cow, but there isn't that same visceral hatred. And is there the same visceral hatred of grizzly bears that we often perceive as that we hear about all the time for wolves?
No, I don't think there is. In my experience, and I've worked a lot on wolves as well as grizzly bears. Grizzly bears happens to be my complete and utter insane passion, but I've worked a lot. I was involved in the reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone and stuff, and so I've been to a lot of hearings and talked to a lot of people about wolves too, and I have not run into that kind of amazingly deep-seated hatred of wolves, of grizzly bears, as I've seen with wolves. But they're inconvenient. They're big and they eat cows and they're inconvenient. I remember talking, there was a woman I talked to who was terrified of bears. She wouldn't go into a grizzly bear habitat. She wouldn't camp in grizzly bear habitat. And she was well aware that most of the grizzly bear attacks were females defending their cubs. And her remark was really straightforward. She says, I wouldn't go in a grizzly, I'm not going to go camp in Yellowstone, but, you know, mom's got to do what a mom's got to do. And I thought, that's really interesting. It wasn't like kill the damn bears. It was like this begrudging respect. And I've run into that begrudging respect from other ranchers, like this, you know, they're kind of, bears are kind of this endangered, you know, individualistic Westerner too. You know, they're not romanticized. Really, by the ranchers, but there is this begrudging respect. But they are a pain in the ass to people, and there are certain pockets, like this one area, the Upper Green River Basin in Wyoming, not too far from Jackson, where grizzly bears are eating quite a few cows, and these ranchers happen to be politically well connected and very conservative, and a grizzly bear hunt ever gets institutionalized, and hopefully we're going to be able to stop it, that's where the hunting is going to be an extermination hunt, and the rancher is going to be behind it. So it's, you know, while it's not, hatred is not widespread as with wolves aimed at grizzly bears, there are still places like that area where, you know, if they get a chance, there are going to be no more grizzly bears.
And
cows.
Are there the same sort of programs for grizzly bears eating cows as there are for wolves killing cows, where if a grizzly bear eats your cow, then you will get paid?
Yes, and financial compensation program in some states, Wyoming in particular, they pay more than what the animal's worth. I mean, it's incredible.
See, this just blows me away, too. Sorry, go ahead.
No. I mean, it blows me away that the taxpayers subsidize the paying of more than the value of the animal to, in the case of the Upper Green River, these are not, you know, marginal ranchers. These are millionaire ranchers. You were heavily subsidized on public land anyway, who are providing habitat for threatened species and then lose a cow and get, you know, paid for again by taxpayers for the loss of an animal. It drives me nuts, actually.
Well, this also is just, honestly, if I were a cattle rancher in that area and I was getting paid more than market value, I would be putting out, like, bear calls or something, because you're getting paid more. I mean, the cow's going to get killed anyway.
And that's actually happening. There's enough leaks in the Forest Service and some of the agencies that are monitoring, like, that particular situation, where sick calves are being left and not doctored so they can be bear bait, essentially.
But then if you do that, don't complain. Don't complain.
Right.
I mean, that you think that if you're getting paid more than market value, you would want the grizzly bears there because you're actually going to make, you know, $1,100 for a cow instead of $1,000 or whatever. You know, you're going to make more for a cow than you would if you sold it to a packing plant. So you'd think you would welcome them as a capitalist.
But it's not that's the rational response. I mean, these people are trying to have it both ways. If you've got a hotline to the governor and you can get paid and you can whine and get ink, you're going to do both.
Yeah, I hear you. It just makes me mad.
Yeah, it's infuriating. And, you know, it's sort of the myth of the cowboy. You know, it's impossible to, it's not impossible because here I am challenging it, but, and you are too. The myth of the cowboy is so powerful. You know, this romantic view of the cowboy in the West can do no wrong. But here, you know, grizzly bears, the ranching-related cow losses are one of the leading causes of grizzly bear deaths in Great Yellowstone now. And most of the ranchers are not trying. And I should say some ranchers really are trying. There's one friend of mine who's a rancher in Montana, and she has a lot of grizzly bears on her place. And she has heavily armed cows in the form of these ancient cows with huge horns. And she does not have a problem. She does not want a problem, and she's going to have a problem. She's going to do something about the cows, not the bears. And so, you know, ranchers are just like, you know, anybody else. There's huge variability. But and she loves having the bears, and she's, like, got tons of pictures of them, and, you know, but so they're all different. But there are too many whiner ranchers who are not trying very hard.
So I did the math on, I don't know if you know, I don't remember the name, but there was a rancher in Upper Central Washington who lost some cows to wolves and then made this big deal. He made a big political point out of it. They killed the entire wolf pack because of it. And I actually did the math. They made it sound like this guy was going out of business because he lost like 5 cows. It ends up that he runs, I don't remember the numbers now, but this represented like a half of 1% of total loss. And I was thinking, any business that can't survive a half of 1% loss shouldn't be in business anyway.
Right.
And so how many cows are killed every year by grizzly bears?
I'm not sure total. Last year was a big year of cow losses, and I think there were like 80.
80 out of how many cows total in Montana / Wyoming?
Like, in the Great Yellowstone, there's like 400,000.
So in other
words,
this is completely trivial.
Totally.
Yeah. And so let's step away from ranchers for a second and pretend that ranchers and hunters weren't killing any grizzly bears. What are other threats to grizzly bears in that region right now? And then we'll come back to the ranchers in a second.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so the uber threats are the ongoing high levels of killing. People, despite their threatened status, people are the number one reason that grizzly bears die. I mean, they don't die of natural causes typically in the ecosystem, which is really sad. Bears habituated to garbage, you know, and bears that get habituated become a nuisance and wind up dead from, you know, mostly because the agencies kill them. That's still a big problem. Habitat threats in the sense of ongoing development of habitat, private land development is a big issue. Energy development in some parts of the ecosystem is a big issue. In the southern part of Greater Yellowstone, there's quite a lot of energy development, and there's quite a lot of land leased that's potentially developed, you know, could be developed. Road building and roads are a huge issue. In this case, old logging roads that are now getting used by off-road vehicles increasingly. And that's a problem because roads kill bears is sort of the shorthand. So the more roads you have, the more access to people, the more poaching goes on. And roads also fragment habitat. They displace bears. So you've got on public lands too many roads, the failure of the Forest Service to close roads or close them very effectively. We still have a fair amount of poaching that goes on. I mean, malicious poaching that goes on. So habitat loss and climate change is not, of course, done with us yet. I mean, we've lost the high elevation white birch pine forest and that huge food. We've also lost, due to climate change and invasive species, lake trout. We've lost cutthroat trout, which was a huge food for grizzly bears in the core of the ecosystem around Yellowstone Lake and its tributaries. We've lost it functionally, and we're going to lose more. Climate models project significant loss of a number of the key berries that bears used. And last summer, which was a really high mortality year, record high mortality year for grizzly bears in Yellowstone, was partly contributed to from a bad berry year, but welcome to the future. They're all going to be bad berry years.
You know, this is another thing that makes me really upset, is that you take away the bear's primary food source, and then, not you, one, you know,
yeah.
and then they complain when the bears go to garbage dumps or get into a dumpster. It's like,
right.
What do you expect them to do when you have taken away the salmon or bison or whoever it was that they were eating before?
Right. Well, that's exactly, and that's what's happened. So we lost cutthroat trout, two of the big four foods of Yellowstone, white birch pine and cutthroat trout, two of the big four are gone. And what did bears do? They switched to more meat. I mean, they're not stupid. They're not going to sit on their hands. They switched to eating more meat in the form of elk calves in the spring, and gut piles from hunters in the fall. And they're tuning in to the sound of gunshots because at the other end they know there's going to be a dead elk. So they're tuning into that, and they're tuning into cows. And what's the consequence of bears being bears is them being killed. I mean, there's not a lot of compassion and not a lot of tolerance.
So what
is where we come in. I mean, I think that's where we, you know, people who care. You know, we're talking about the last 1%, the last refuges, the last stand of grizzly bears. In the last wild places, we can recover them in. And we can do better than we are. You know, we can give them a break. You know, they don't have to die from elk hunters killing them or, you know, cattle ranchers, you know, getting them killed by the state agencies.
So if this isn't going to make you feel too dirty and you have to take a shower afterwards, make the best argument that you can that the other side makes for delisting. What is their very best argument?
Their best argument is since the nadir of the population, maybe 1983, when the minimum population count was maybe 300 minimum count, that the population has doubled, tripled in size, and so therefore they're at recovery. And therefore the federal authority should be lifted and the state should have a chance. That's the core of their argument. And their secondary argument is that if they don't remove protections, that somehow there's going to be a social rebellion here and people are going to take the law into their own hands and start killing bears anyway. So they're relieving the social pressure, if you will.
Which, of course, by making that argument, they are actually pushing that argument forward.
Yeah, right. I mean, it doesn't really exist. I mean, it's a fiction, but and so the rebuttal to the first is they're using a minimum count of 300 against a total count of 720 or so, and also 700 is hardly recovery. It's a totally isolated population, has been for 100 years. No conservation biologist would claim success at 720 of an isolated population, permanently isolated. And even Fish and Wildlife Service says it's going to be on permanent life support. You're going to be importing bears every 10 years or so because of genetic problems. And so our response, my response is, hey, if we can reconnect Yellowstone bears naturally to Canada through central Idaho, of course we have to get bears recovered in central Idaho, Frank Church River of No Return, the Salmon Selwood System, and connect bears on up into Glacier and the Canadian wilderness, let's do it. The land is still there. And, of course, we'd have to work with local communities and institute coexistence programs so bears don't get into trouble with garbage, et cetera. But let's try to do recovery in the natural way instead of relying on some artificial resuscitation program forever. So that's my response to the numbers. And the more science there is on numbers and recovery, recovery numbers look more like what real recovery looks like is more like 5,000. Some would say 10,000. We're never going to get to 10,000 probably in the lower 48 states without a lot of work, but we can certainly get to 5,000. And we can get bears in other places that we haven't thought of. There's still suitable habitat in California. There's still suitable habitat in the Southwest on the border of Arizona and New Mexico. It'd be very cool to get grizzly bears back into an oak ecosystem. Those behaviors, foraging behaviors, have gone. You know, bears have figured out instantly. And so we've been narrowly constrained in terms of our vision, our imagination, to where bears were relegated at the time of listing, not where suitable habitat still remains. So, you know, the Southwest, there's still habitat in Colorado. You know, there's still lots of, Oregon, there's still lots of suitable habitat to support, recovered populations. And yet Fish and Wildlife Service, all they can talk about is removing protections because they think they're saving the Endangered Species Act by giving the states, you know, authority, which is a silly argument. You're never going to satisfy the states of Idaho and Wyoming and Montana by giving them authority over large carnivores. All they're going to do is kill them down to promote their big game herds.
Yeah. Do you want to give one or two sentences on – I lived in North Idaho for a few years. I lived in northeastern Nevada for a couple years before that. I lived in eastern Washington for 10 years. So I'm very – one of the high points of my activist career was when I told Jim McClure that I wanted to see him on trial for crimes against nature.
Good for you.
Yeah, the security came in and removed me.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, leave that aside. So can you give one or two sentences – For people who might live in the East or the South or something, about just how bad environmental politics are in Idaho?
Well, Idaho, unfortunately, is not that much different from Wyoming and Montana. But Idaho is a strangely regressive my orientation to Idaho is eastern Idaho. So, you know, far eastern Idaho in the greater Yellowstone, where it's the ethic of use and domination and death taken to an extreme of, you know, killing anything that gets in your way. I mean, it's sort of the relic of the Old West, sort of romanticized in a crazy way and politicized. So that, you know, your James McClure, is a former senator of Idaho, is alive and well in the form of the current suite of, you know, state elected officials, and similarly in Wyoming and similarly in Montana, that the politics of the past are still in office in these states, and that despite the fact that East Coast people, myself included, moved out to the Northern Rockies and are living there, we haven't changed the politics enough, nearly enough. So the politics of the past are still in the legislatures, you know, calling the shots, ruled by agriculture, essentially, agriculture and hunters, and kind of a morality of the past, of domination and death. And so you've got this strange juxtapose of these newcomers who are bringing with them, you know, they're coming to the mountains, they're coming to see wildlife, they're coming to live, you know, next to big rivers and to be in the company of wild animals and wildness, and they're coming because they respect and revere wild places. And yet you wake up and you're going, whoa, who's in office here? You know, and you realize that they're from an ethos of a different time, and they're in charge, which is why we can't give the keys to the car to the states for large carnivore management, for, you know, wolves or bears, grizzly bears. I mean, and black bears, mountain lions, the same thing. I mean, they're all suffering. It's the wild other. It's, you know, better off dead in their view.
So we have
at the state political level, not individuals necessarily, but that's the ethos of who's in charge, and that's frightening, I find.
Yeah, completely. We have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and
no,
it's great. This is fabulous. And a question before we get to more on the delisting.
Okay.
Say the land was there, and say the agreements were in place. Are grizzly bears really good at re-inhabiting like wolves are? Can they, if it was open to them, would they connect? Would the Yellowstone bears connect to Canada pretty quickly?
Well, so two answers to that. First, grizzly bears are really good. They're constantly monitoring their ecosystem all the time. They're keeping track of what species of plant is edible at what season and nibbling this and nibbling that and testing this. So it won't take them long to figure out what is usable from a bear standpoint at what time of year. So that they'll totally figure that out. But they're slower to recolonize habitat because the way bears do it, in contrast to wolves, is a grizzly bear daughter sets up her territory, they're not really territory, but her range, next to or within the range of her mother, so that grizzly bears expand their range fairly slowly. You know, it's mother to daughter to daughter. So it's a slower recolonization process than what you could do with wolves, you know, that can, you know, move hundreds of miles fairly quickly. But grizzly bears can figure out the habitat well. I mean, and they've certainly proven evolutionarily that they can do it. But they have to be given the time. But they're figuring it out now. I mean, bears have moved further west from Yellowstone into the westward range called the Centennials, and they've recolonized the gravelies already, where people actually are reasonably tolerant, which is cool. And they, you know, so given a chance, if they're not hunted down or hunted to extermination again, which is really easy to do. And one thing I haven't said but I need to say is one reason that bears are really hard to recover and really easy to exterminate is that they have the lowest reproductive rate of any mammal in North America. So a bear mom, grizzly bear mom, doesn't reproduce till she's like 4 or 5. And then she has very small litters. She doesn't, you know, has a litter every other year, every 3 years, and 1, 2, maybe 3 in a litter. So a grizzly bear in Yellowstone has a hard time replacing herself with another reproductive female in her lifetime. So you can't kill that many grizzly bears without affecting the recovery rate of the population. That's why killing matters, and that's why sport hunt matters. Yeah.
So we have 3 or 4 minutes left, and if you and so what would happen? Okay, tell me what the processes are of what they are trying to do to delist and what people can do to stop that delisting.
Okay. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that has authority over recovery of endangered species is going to propose removing protections early in 2006. We're not quite sure. And return authority to the 3 states of Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana, all of whom have plans to hunt, and all of whom will kill grizzly bears much more aggressively than is being done now. There will be a comment period, a public comment period, and the public is urged to comment. I mean, being silent on this would be incredibly detrimental. Really matters that people speak up on behalf of bears. There will be, submitting comments by email, mail. There will be hearings. The comment period is like 30 days, 60 days. We don't know yet. After which the government has to sift through the comments. There'll be a lot of science comments too, I'm sure. And then it's going to wind up in court, and we shall see. The tribes this time around are going to play a big role. The Indian tribes have come out swinging for their kin, and they don't want to see a sport hunt either. To them, they're talking about their spiritual and cultural connections, and a sport hunt is really an anathema. So we'll see, and they're going to court as well.
And so what can somebody who, A, lives in the region do to help? And what about somebody who lives in West Virginia, somewhere completely different? What can each of those two people do if they want to help you? And I want to mention one more thing before you answer that question,
yeah,
which is I just want to mention your website, grizzlytimes.org, www.grizzlytimes.org, where presumably people can keep up to date on this.
Yes. I'm planning to keep up to date. There's a coalition of organizations and individuals tracking this. We're working closely with the Indian tribes, Guardians of Our Ancestors' Legacy. They're doing phenomenal work as well. This is a public, animal in public habitat, and so it really shouldn't matter if you're from the region or from West Virginia. So it matters that you weigh in. It also matters that you submit comments from your own experience or from the heart. If you've been to Yellowstone, if you've experienced public lands, and even if your experience is not with a grizzly bear per se, even if you wish someday to see one or a track of one, it matters that you speak up as an individual. I think too often people are willing to sign a petition, but in this case, it matters for people to speak up as an individual. I'm looking for, and I know other people are as well, developing a network this time of people who really want to engage. Letters to the editor are important. If you're from West Virginia, New Jersey, or wherever, speaking up on the issue in the various venues that you have opportunity. One thing that is really interesting to me are social media opportunities. Cecil the Lion, that many of you may be familiar with, created a huge stir, as did a bear that killed somebody this summer in Yellowstone. Yet her cubs wound up in a zoo because people were so upset about the prospects that the Park Service would have killed them. And I think people can make a huge difference via social media. And we shall test this opportunity during this comment period and after, because I don't think the Park Service and the agencies know how this is going to wind up.
So, last question. You and the other people beat back the attempt to delist,
mm-hmm.
and then in a groundswell of support, you become nominated as queen of all things grizzly bear. And what you can't bring down civilization, you can't bring down capitalism, you can't do those for like at least a year. So, within the current structure, what policies would you want to see implemented vis-a-vis grizzly bear? I mean, you've said you want them reintroduced. So is that, what would be your policies? If you could do anything you want.
Reintroducing grizzly bears to central Idaho is key because there's plenty of suitable habitat. Keeping them on the list everywhere is key because without that we can't, we don't have a starting base to get to recovery, although we're still a long ways away from it. Preventing any additional habitat loss as grizzly bears try to compensate for the loss of foods due to climate change. So no more road building, no more energy development in grizzly bear habitat. Just no more of grizzly bears, we've all compromised enough until grizzly bears have until things have settled down and grizzly bears have adjusted to the changes that have already taken place. I would also institutionalize a coexistence program that's really serious, that doesn't allow people to just kill bears if they have a problem, that says you have to try. And trying means, trying to reduce conflicts with cows, you know, not letting people just, you know, claim self-defense and kill a grizzly bear over a carcass, which is happening now. You have to try to resolve your differences.
Well, I would like to thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Louisa Wilcox. This is Derek Jensen of Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.